Chapter 7. And grim depression for want of the open water. I was chief mate, and very much alone. Directly I had joined, I received from my owners instructions to send all the ship's apprentices away on leave together, because in such weather there was nothing for anybody to do, unless to keep up a fire in the cabin stove. That was attended to by a snuffy and mop-headed, inconceivably dirty, and weirdly toothless Dutch shipkeeper, who could hardly speak three words of English, but who must have had some considerable knowledge of the language, since he managed invariably to interpret in the contrary sense everything that was said to him. Notwithstanding the little iron stove, the ink froze on the swing table in the cabin, and I found it more convenient to go ashore stumbling over the Arctic wasteland and shivering in glazed trampers in order to write my evening letter to my owners, in a gorgeous cafe in the center of the town. It was an immense place, lofty, and gilt, upholstered in red plush, full of electric lights, and so thoroughly warmed, that even the marble tables felt tepid to the touch. The waiter who brought me my cup of coffee bore, by comparison with my utter isolation, the dear aspect of an intimate friend. There, alone in a noisy crowd, I would write slowly a letter addressed to Glasgow, of which the gist would be: there is no cargo, and no prospect of any coming till late spring apparently. And all the time I sat there, the necessity of getting back to the ship bore heavily on my already half-congealed spirits. The shivering in glazed trampers, the stumbling over the snow-sprinkled waste ground, the vision of ships frozen in a row, appearing vaguely like corpses of black vessels in a white world, so silent, so lifeless, so soulless they seemed to be. With precaution I would go up the side of my own particular corpse, and would feel her as cold as ice itself, and as slippery under my feet. My cold berth would swallow up like a chilly burial niche my bodily shivers and my mental excitement. It was a cruel winter. The very air seemed as hard and trenchant as steel, but it would have taken much more than this to extinguish my sacred fire for the exercise of my craft. No young man of 24 appointed chief mate for the first time in his life would have let that Dutch tenacious winter penetrate into his heart. I think that in those days I never forgot the fact of my elevation for 5 consecutive minutes. I fancy it kept me warm, even in my slumbers, better than the high pile of blankets, which positively crackled with frost as I threw them off in the morning. And I would get up early for no reason whatever, except that I was in sole charge. The new captain had not been appointed yet. Almost each morning a letter from my owners would arrive, directing me to go to the charterers and clamor for the ship's cargo, to threaten them with the heaviest penalties of demurrage, to demand that this assortment of varied merchandise, set fast in a landscape of ice and windmills somewhere up country, should be put on rail instantly, and fed up to the ship in regular quantities every day. After drinking some hot coffee, like an Arctic explorer setting off on a sledge journey towards the North Pole, I would go ashore and roll shivering in a tramper into the very heart of the town, past clean-faced houses, past thousands of brass knockers upon a thousand painted doors glimmering behind rows of trees of the pavement species, leafless, gaunt, seemingly dead forever. That part of the expedition was easy enough, though the horses were painfully glistening with icicles, and the aspect of the tram conductors' faces presented a repulsive blending of crimson and purple. But as to frightening or bullying, or even wheedling some sort of answer out of Mr. Hudig, that was another matter altogether. He was a big swarthy Netherlander, with black mustaches and a bold glance. He always began by shoving me into a chair, before I had time to open my mouth, gave me cordially a large cigar, and in excellent English would start to talk everlastingly about the phenomenal severity of the weather. It was impossible to threaten a man who, though he possessed the language perfectly, seemed incapable of understanding any phrase pronounced in a tone of remonstrance or discontent. As to quarreling with him, it would have been stupid. The weather was too bitter for that. His office was so warm, his fire so bright, his sides shook so heartily with laughter, that I experienced always a great difficulty in making up my mind to reach for my hat. At last the cargo did come. At first it came dribbling in by rail and trucks, till the thaw set in, and then fast, in a multitude of barges, with a great rush of unbound waters. The gentle master stevedore had his hands very full at last, and the chief mate became worried in his mind as to the proper distribution of the weight of his first cargo in a ship he did not personally know before. Ships do want humoring. They want humoring in handling, and if you mean to handle them well, they must have been humored in the distribution of the weight which you ask them to carry through the good and evil fortune of a passage. Your ship is a tender creature, whose idiosyncrasies must be attended to, if you mean her to come with credit to herself and you through the rough and tumble of her life. XV. So seemed to think the new captain, who arrived the day after we had finished loading, on the very eve of the day of sailing. I first beheld him on the quay, a complete stranger to me, obviously not a Hollander, in a black bowler and a short drab overcoat, ridiculously out of tone with the winter aspect of the wastelands, beordered by the brown fronts of houses with their roofs dripping with melting snow. This stranger was walking up and down absorbed in the marked contemplation of the ship's fore and aft trim, but when I saw him squat on his heels in the slush at the very edge of the quay to peer at the draft of water under her counter, I said to myself, "This is the captain." And presently I descried his luggage coming along a real sailor's chest, carried by means of rope beckets between two men, with a couple of leather portmanteaus, and a roll of charts sheeted in canvas piled upon the lid. The sudden, spontaneous agility with which he bounded aboard right off the rail, afforded me the first glimpse of his real character. Without further preliminaries than a friendly nod, he addressed me. "You have got her pretty well in her fore and aft trim. Now, what about your weights?" I told him I had managed to keep the weight sufficiently well up, as I thought, one third of the whole, being in the upper part above the beams, as the technical expression has it. He whistled "phew," scrutinizing me from head to foot. A sort of smiling vexation was visible on his ruddy face. "Well, we shall have a lively time of it this passage, I bet," he said. He knew. It turned out he had been chief mate of her for the two preceding voyages, and I was already familiar with his handwriting in the old log books I had been perusing in my cabin with a natural curiosity, looking up the records of my new ship's luck, of her behavior, of the good times as he had had, and of the troubles she had escaped. He was right in his prophecy. On our passage from Amsterdam to Samarang with a general cargo, of which, alas, only one third in weight was stowed above the beams, we had a lively time of it. It was lively, but not joyful. There was not even a single moment of comfort in it, because no seaman can feel comfortable in body or mind when he has made his ship uneasy. To travel along with a cranky ship for 90 days or so is no doubt a nerve-trying experience. But in this case, what was wrong with our craft was this: that by my system of loading as he had been made much too stable. Neither before nor since have I felt a ship roll so abruptly, so violently, so heavily. Once she began, you felt that she would never stop, and this hopeless sensation, characterizing the motion of ships whose center of gravity is brought down too low in loading, made everyone on board weary of keeping on his feet. I remember once overhearing one of the hands say, "Why heavens, Jack, I feel as if I didn't mind how soon I let myself go, and let the blamed hooker knock my brains out if she likes." The captain used to remark frequently, "H, yes, I dare say one third weight above beams would have been quite enough for most ships. But then, you see, there's no two of them alike on the seas, and she's an uncommonly ticklish jade to load. Down south, running before the gales of high latitudes, she made our life a burden to us. There were days when nothing would keep even on the swing tables, when there was no position where you could fix yourself so as not to feel a constant strain upon all the muscles of your body. She rolled and rolled with an awful dislodging jerk, and that dizzily fast sweep of her masts on every swing. It was a wonder that the men sent aloft were not flung off the yards not flung off the masts not flung overboard. The captain in his armchair, holding on grimly at the head of the table, with the soup tureen rolling on one side of the cabin, and the steward sprawling on the other, would observe, looking at me, "Hats here one-third above the beams. The only thing that surprises me is that the sticks have stuck to her all this time." Ultimately some of the minor spars did go nothing important. Spanker booms and such like, because at times the frightful impetus of her rolling would part a fourfold tackle of new 3-inch manila line, as if it were weaker than pack thread. It was only poetic justice that the chief mate, who had made a mistake, perhaps a half-excusable one, about the distribution of his ship's cargo, should pay the penalty. A piece of one of the minor spars that did carry away flew against the chief mate's back, and sent him sliding on his face for quite a considerable distance along the main deck. Thereupon followed various and unpleasant consequences of a physical order earlier symptoms, as the captain, who treated them, used to say, inexplicable periods of powerlessness, sudden accesses of mysterious pain. And the patient agreed fully with the regretful mutters of his very attentive captain, wishing that it had been a straightforward broken leg. Even the Dutch doctor who took the case up in Samarang offered no scientific explanation. All he said was, "H, friend, you are young yet. It may be very serious for your whole life. You must leave your ship. You must quite silent before 3 months, quite silent." Of course, he meant the chief mate to keep quiet, to lay up, as a matter of fact. His manner was impressive enough, if his English was childishly imperfect, when compared with the fluency of Mr. Hudig, the figure at the other end of that passage, and memorable enough in its way. In a great airy ward of a far eastern hospital, lying on my back, I had plenty of leisure to remember the dreadful cold and snow of Amsterdam, while looking at the fronds of the palm trees tossing and rustling at the height of the window. I could remember the elated feeling, and the soul-gripping cold of those tramway journeys taken into town, to put what in diplomatic language is called pressure upon the good Hudig, with his warm fire, his armchair, his big cigar, and the never-failing suggestion in his good-natured voice. Suppose in the end it is you they will appoint captain before the ship sails? It may have been his extreme good nature, the serious, unsmiling good nature of a fat, swarthy man with coal-black mustache and steady eyes, but he might have been a bit of a diplomatist too. His enticing suggestions I used to repel modestly by the assurance that it was extremely unlikely, as I had not enough experience. "Who know very well how to go about business matters," he used to say, with a sort of affected moodiness clouding his serene round face. I wonder whether he ever laughed to himself after I had left the office. I dare say he never did, because I understand that diplomatists, in and out of the career, take themselves and their tricks with an exemplary seriousness. But he had nearly persuaded me that I was fit in every way to be trusted with a command. There came 3 months of mental worry, hard rolling, remorse, and physical pain to drive home the lesson of insufficient experience. Yes, your ship wants to be humored with knowledge. You must treat with an understanding consideration the mysteries of her feminine nature, and then she will stand by you faithfully in the unceasing struggle with forces wherein defeat is no shame. It is a serious relation, that in which a man stands to his ship. As he has her rights, as though she could breathe and speak, and, indeed, there are ships that, for the right man, will do anything but speak, as the saying goes. A ship is not a slave. You must make her easy in a seaway. You must never forget that you owe her the fullest share of your thought, of your skill, of your self-love. If you remember that obligation, naturally and without effort, as if it were an instinctive feeling of your inner life, she will sail, stay, run for you, as long as she is able, or, like a seabird going, to rest upon the angry waves, she will lay out the heaviest gale that ever made you doubt living long enough to see another sunrise. XVI. Often I turn with melancholy eagerness to the space reserved in the newspapers under the general heading of Shipping Intelligence. I meet there the names of ships I have known. Every year some of these names disappear, the names of old friends. M. by Pasadi. The different divisions of that kind of news are set down in their order, which varies but slightly in its arrangement of concise headlines. And first comes Peking's reports of ships met and signaled at sea, name, port, where from, where bound for, so many days out, ending frequently with the words, LLL. Then come wrecks and casualties, a longish array of paragraphs, unless the weather has been fair and clear, and friendly to ships all over the world. On some days there appears the heading Virtue, an ominous threat of loss and sorrow trembling yet in the balance of fate. There is something sinister to a seaman in the very grouping of the letters which form this word, clear in its meaning, and seldom threatening in vain. Only a very few days, more appallingly few to the hearts which had set themselves bravely to hope against hope, 3 weeks, a month later, perhaps, the name of ships under the blight of the Virtue heading shall appear again in the column of Shipping Intelligence, but under the final declaration of Issing. The ship, or bark, or brig so-and-so, bound from such a port, with such and such cargo, for such another port, having left at such and such a date, last spoken at sea on such a day, and never having been heard of since, was posted today as missing. Such in its strictly official eloquence is the form of funeral orations on ships that, perhaps wearied with a long struggle, or in some unguarded moment that may come to the readiest of us, had let themselves be overwhelmed by a sudden blow from the enemy. Who can say? Perhaps the men she carried had asked her to do too much, had stretched beyond breaking point the enduring faithfulness which seems wrought and hammered into that assemblage of iron ribs and plating, of wood and steel and canvas and wire, which goes to the making of a ship a complete creation endowed with character, individuality, qualities and defects, by men whose hands launch her upon the water, and that other men shall learn to know with an intimacy surpassing the intimacy of man with man, to love with a love nearly as great as that of man for woman, and often as blind in its infatuated disregard of defects. There are ships which bear a bad name, but I have yet to meet one. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.